Hello, and welcome to the Psychology Podcast with Dr. Scott Barry Kaufman, where we give you insights into the mind, brain, behavior, and creativity. Each episode will feature a new guest who will stimulate your mind and give you a greater understanding of yourself, others, and the world we live in. Hopefully, we'll also provide a glimpse into human possibility. Thanks for listening and enjoy the podcast. Really excited to have Dr. Docker Keltner on the podcast. Docker is a professor of psychology at the University of California, Berkeley, and the founding director of the university's Greater Good Science Center. Keltner has devoted his career to studying the nature of human goodness and happiness, conducting groundbreaking research on compassion, awe, laughter, and love. He is the author of the best-selling book, Born to Be Good, and his latest book, which we'll be discussing today, is called The Power Paradox, How We Gain and Lose Influence. Hey, thanks so much for being on the show twice.
It's good being with you again, Scott.
Yay. I always enjoy chatting with you. And I thought, you know, last time we focused more on your work on all laughter and love. And I thought, you know, today, particularly under a certain political climate we're living in, thought maybe we could talk about power.
Yeah, very timely, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Can you please start by defining what you mean by power?
Yeah, so very simply, by power, I, and then the social scientific field, mean your capacity to influence another person, your capacity to change their minds or their actions or their feelings. So it's really about influence.
So this is a really interesting definition of power that is very broad and could encompass different motives for that.
Yeah. You know, Scott, when I started reading about power 20 years ago, people in the scientific literature thought about it as politics, right? You have access to political decision-making as money and wealth. And as a psychologist like you, I felt frustrated with that definition because, A, those definitions of power as politics or money or military might don't help us understand the power of politics in families and in romantic partnerships or friendships. And then, B, I think they really do a disservice to those definitions as power as money and might and politics in understanding how societies change, right? Yeah. There is enormous innovation and social change and societal movement that's brought about by people who don't have a lot of money, who don't have military might, but they lead the civil rights movement, they create the internet. So I wanted to broaden, like you say, our thinking about power.
Yeah, and that definition encompasses the whole spectrum of wanting to alter the states of others in a way that gives you like complete control over them to wanting to alter the states of others. To, I'm trying to think of the complete opposite of that spectrum would be in a way that is uplifting to everyone.
Really spectacular observation. In fact, that's where we're going with our research, which is once you think about power as just your capacity to influence the people around you and then the people they influence, you can array the ways in which we influence on a dimension or a continuum. And on one side is the coercive, bullying, Machiavellian, sociopathic tendencies, right?
Absolutely.
And on the other side is what I really profile more in the book, which I think we're moving slowly toward, which is ways of empowering other people, sharing resources, building strong social networks that get you power. So you can really start to make sense of the different strategies by which we gain power.
Well, that's so interesting. So you said sharing resources. So sharing resources versus grabbing resources seems to be an important distinction, right?
Yeah, you know, and it's really counterintuitive and people don't realize, but once you start to think about it deeply, the really revealing examples come to mind, which is that, you know, in hunter-gatherer societies, it's really the individual who shares the most, who has the highest standing. There are studies of teenagers in the United States, and it's the kid. And this shocks parents, right? It's the kid who's kind and breaks up conflicts and helps other kids who has the highest status in that group. When you get to great acts of leadership in the work world, right? Jim Collins in his book, From Good to Great, talks about the final stage of leadership is service, is really bringing out the good in others as your pathway to power. So I think there's surprising support for this idea.
I agree. And I'm wondering how you link this. I'm sure you're aware of the distinction in the evolutionary psychology literature between authentic pride and hubristic pride. as two different paths to social status. You could equally say there are two different paths to power, right?
Yeah, no, what a terrific connection, Scott. You know, it's great to, you know, and this is just new thinking in the last couple of years that the evolutionary world of people like Jess Tracy and Joey Chang and Joseph Henrich, they're talking about two paths to power, right? Yeah. And one is domination and manipulation, pinning people down, right? Or tricking them. And then the other is means by which you gain status and respect. And I think that's a fair summary that in some contexts, if you're working in a Mexican drug cartel or you're dealing arms, it's all about domination and tricking people and coercion and threat, right? And by contrast, if you're working in a hospital or in a biotech firm or the like, more often it's about, you know, doing things that gain you status, like doing great work and building strong ties.
So do you think that the feeling of pride, like the evolved feeling itself, is the same feeling that like a mob boss feels when they kill an underling who's disrespected them as the person who helps change the world and sort of like sees a huge grandiose impact that they made in the world? Is it the same feeling?
Yeah. You know, I think that, and this,
we should study that subjective qualia, whether or not that's the same feeling.
It is. And I think that you're going to find both similarities and differences, right? So, you know, the structure of pride, as Jess Tracy has shown, just like feeling like I've done good things, I have strength, I'm high in a social hierarchy, is common to hubristic, arrogant, narcissistic pride, and then this more authentic pride. But that kind of the arrogant narcissism and is really the kind of feeling of stature that we have to worry about. And I write about in the power paradox, which is the minute your sense of pride and success and wealth and, you know, making it in the world is accompanied by beliefs like, wow, I'm really fundamentally better than other people, or I should really dominate the world, these other people are second rate, you're in trouble, right? And one worries about the current political climate with this distinction in mind. And what we really should be looking for, where the subjective differences really are matters, authentic pride, I think, always is accompanied by a sense of other people's contributions to your work, right? Your place within a broader tradition or a historical narrative. So I think there are subjective differences between these two kinds of pride that speak a lot to the problems of power.
I love that. I wanted to think through for a moment without trying to change people who they are. Like, what if you are the type of person, you know, if we talk interpersonal circumplex, what if you are, you know, so strong on the social dominance side and very low on love? I mean, is there a place for you in the world? The thing is, are you telling people they should change who they are? Like, maybe they could like make a great contribution in sports or certain leadership positions. Do you see what I'm saying? Like, is there always that authentic pride wins, you know?
No, not at all. You know, and I think that what I write about in the power paradox is in the last 50 years, and this is work by Alice Egli and her colleagues, we've moved from a more social dominance, domineering, coercive form of power top down to a more horizontal, empowering, collaborative form of power, right? So in general, the data show if you're more collaborative and empathetic, you'll fare pretty well. But there are places for pure, assertive, domineering power, right? When I talk to, for example, business groups, and some of them are doing really complicated negotiations with like Russians, right? It's good to have a domineering type on your team. I think you're suggesting it's good to have somebody on your team who takes no crap from anybody else and will be forceful, right? There are interesting speculations about sports teams, about it's great to collaborate like the Warriors do, but it's also good to have an enforcer who's like, you push my guy around, I'm coming after you, right? So I think in general, we find that a mixture of strategies is good. It's good to be able to fight fire with fire if somebody is bullying you, and to stand up to bullying.
I like that.
With calmness but strength. But in general, there is this trend towards greater collaboration in the politics of power these days.
You're saying that in politics these days, there's a trend towards which side, did you say?
Well, no, what I meant is in a lot of different sectors, right? So in workplace organizations, in hospital settings, in school settings, there's more, power is more bidirectional, it's horizontal. The one exception.
I was going to say, wait a minute.
Is politics of the day, where there has been this rise or return of more top-down authoritarian power, which we're worried about.
Yeah, you know, it just seems to me like there are certain people would really love in sports and reality TV, but that just really, that's not what we want as a president of the United States.
Yeah.
You know, I think to myself, you know, I've been a big fan of Michael Jordan's career, but a lot of people say that what he does on the field, you know, on the basketball court is akin to like psychopathy. You know, he bullies, he intimidates others, he's vengeful. His number one thing is to win and but not only win, but kill, you know?
Yeah.
So now look, we love that and admire that as a society when we watch him on the thing. In the context of United President, can you imagine if Michael Jordan was president of the United States? I mean, and he had that same attitude. Yeah. We would not want that for that position. So I just think so much is so contextual, you know, and you know what I'm saying? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, Scott, your observation is so fundamental for your audience to really dwell upon, which is that, you know, we have these stereotypes of what it means to be powerful, right? And they're influenced by Machiavelli and this 500-year-old legacy of power. And Machiavelli wrote, "In the most violent time in human history." And it was a theory of power about manipulation and coercion for very violent times. And then we think of power stereotypically by invoking images of really exceptional people. Michael Jordan is a 1 in a billion person in terms of basketball skills, right?
It's true.
But real facts are, how do we influence in our families? How do we influence in our romantic partnerships? How do we, when the rest of us and not Michael Jordan go to work, how do we get things done? How do we get things done as a member of a community or a school? And there the data are really a counterpoint to the Michael Jordan model of power, which is you get more done collaboratively, right? And even nowadays they're finding, you know, that financial firms and governments that have more collaborative members get a lot more work done, and they're better for the bottom line, right? So I think we really, as you are doing, we have to question the image of power. And it is not Donald Trump anymore, right? It is much more likely to be a woman today, much more likely to be a person of a different ethnic background. And we have to embrace this shift in power that Trump is a reaction to.
I think that's right. And I think I'm also trying to make another point that I really am not articulating well, but as you're talking, I think I'm able to better do that now. And that's, you know, that there still is a fundamental human drive for this hubristic pride. It's still part, it's within us. And I think when we watch sports or we watch like wrestling or we watch, it allows us to vicariously get it out of our system. You know, the winning losing mentality, which is the extreme of the dominant side of the interpersonal circumplex, is still a fundamental human need. It's not like the us versus them, you know, it's not like, oh, we have the narcissists and then we have the rest of us. So I just feel like there are certain things that offer healthy, vicarious, like we watch at reality TV. We like, you know, you're fired. I mean, Trump was popular for a reason, right? But now he's not popular for a reason. It's interesting to think about that. Do you know what I mean? He was popular for a reason within a particular context, and that's what got him elected. And now he's in this different context and the same traits are not. So I think this segues to your power paradox. Is that right?
Yeah, that's a terrific segue. You know, so
it's kind of the inverse. It's kind of the inverse. Trump is the inverse of your power paradox.
He is the inverse, which is he rose to power in counterintuitive ways, but now he's falling predictably. Yeah. So, you know, and I really appreciate your point, Scott. And one of the points of the power paradox and all the studies we've been doing for 20 years is that it isn't just the weirdos or the sociopaths who can get into trouble with power, right? Our lab studies show you take any human being and you give them some power and they start to have that hubristic pride. They feel they're a little bit better than other people and they feel the surges of desire, like, I want this, or I want to sleep with that person, or I want more money, right? And we get into trouble. And our studies show, just like you say, like, this is just a human thing to misuse power. And when you have power, you're more likely to lie to people and cheat in games and take candy in a lab study that was meant for kids. And drive like a maniac, you know, blazing through the pedestrian zone. So this is a really, we all have done this, right? We've all misused power. It's not just the nuts who do it. It's really a human tendency. And so that then brings in, you know, this question of the paradox of power, which is we rise to power through lots of good things in human nature, and then we can misuse it. And I think the lesson of Trump is that is a lesson of how we keep using power well, which is you got to watch it because other people are going to hold you accountable. Your reputation's going to fall. Your influence in the distal sense, like the U.S. reputation in the United States, outside of the United States right now, has just fallen, has plummeted as a result of these kind of impulsive behaviors of Trump, where people literally don't take us that seriously on the international stage anymore. It's going to cost us dearly. And those are the reminders of the power paradox of not misusing the power we earned with good works to stay close to the better side to our human nature.
Yeah, I mean, it's such an important reminder for all of us when we get power, what it can do to us. Dopamine is really addictive. You know, in that circumplex, you know, my colleague Colin DeYoung has been doing some great work on personality neuroscience showing that if you're really high on that social dominance thing, that's pure dopamine. It's not necessarily aggression. The thing is, it's not necessarily testosterone. That's more when you get the antagonism, which is the left side of that circle. But when you're just straight up social dominance, which is just orthogonal to love, that's straight up like pure dopamine. And I think that's the point you're trying to make.
Yeah. And, you know, that literature really guided this thinking about the abuses of power, Scott, which is dopamine is about going after things that you crave and desire, as you know really well, like going after this.
I do.
Not you personally, you know, flirting with somebody so that it leads to a sexual tryst, you know, getting involved in drugs, wanting more money, wanting to take money. That's all dopamine addictive behavior. And, you know, Scott, when I started to do this work on power, there were two things that really struck me when I watched the behavior of people who are really feeling the surges of power. One is how much they look like addicts. They just wanted more. There was no constraint on what they wanted. They look like they're dopamine driven. And regrettably, and this has actually been verified by science, they look like people who had had brain damage, right? Wow. There are studies showing if you damage the frontal lobes, parts of the frontal lobes, you act impulsively, you swear at people, you make sexual passes, you are greedy. And there are studies by Sukhvindir Obi at McMaster University showing when I feel powerful, it disengages my frontal lobes. and I write about this in the paragraph. So that's a really problematic mixture of being addicted to dopamine minus your frontal lobes.
It's such a good point. And, you know, I find it interesting that there's like Colin and others are starting to map out this two different dopamine pathways. One that's more related to what we're talking about, which are repetitive rewards, which are very ancestral, like status, money, and power. But then there's also a newer evolved pathway with projections to the prefrontal cortex itself, which is more about the reward value of information and curiosity and the reward. So not the reward value of appetitive rewards, but the reward value of understanding and reducing information. And I feel like I'm a dopamine junkie on that second one. Like, I'll admit it, I'm a dopamine junkie when it comes to cure. You know what I mean? That's why we're having this conversation to begin with. And maybe you are too.
Totally. It keeps me up too late at night. And it keeps me returning to your show, Scott. Well, it's really interesting. And this may be a way to think about the upside to power and the downside to power. The downside to power is when you hyperactivate that older dopamine system that you're talking about, which just makes you swear at people and make sexual passes and get greedy. But maybe the upside to power is the social side that you're talking about. And on that, you know, it's so interesting. I hadn't made this connection until you brought it up. Anna Gwinnett in Europe has these great studies showing when I feel powerful, I'm too driven by my own fleshy desires. But the upside is I really can look at social situations and know, like, this is the most socially important thing to do right here, right? This is the most valuable social course of action, like get my team to work on this part of the problem or, you know, solve that conflict. So maybe that's the rewarding side to power that we need to bring into focus. I wish I had known about that before writing The Power Paradox.
Well, yeah, no, this is, I'm really glad we're having this conversation. And did I hear you say that you listen to the psychology podcast?
Yeah.
Did you just say that like about 3 minutes ago?
Yes.
Like I just processed that. I am, I'm incredibly honored that that is true.
Oh, well, every now and then I need new sources of wisdom.
I just got a dopamine hit by you saying that.
And you're blushing.
I am. It's true. It's true. Well, you know, this is, I mean, we can really get like nuanced here in a way that might be fun. You know, the extroversion domain is comprised of two main facets, social dominance / assertiveness, but also social affiliation or social vitality. They're correlated with each other, but the vitality facet is the only one that's correlated with compassion, whereas the dominance one is actually uncorrelated with compassion. So that's an interesting example that when you look at the sub-facets, actually the technically the aspects, the two aspects of extroversion, there's one aspect of extroversion that is linked to the agreeableness, specifically compassion domain, and another one that's like pure dopamine. So there's one that's like wanting and liking, and there's one that's just wanting system.
Yeah.
And that seems relevant here. Yeah.
Very relevant. And what a terrific observation. You know, there are 60 or 70 studies, and we've done some of them, that if you are extroverted, you will rise in the ranks as a school kid, in a dorm, in a fraternity, sorority, sports team, military unit, in the workplace. That social effervescence of extroversion gets you status and power. And I think, you know, when I asked Oliver John about this, and he and I published on this, you know, and he's a preeminent figure in this Big Five world, he said it really is the social affiliative, connective side to extroversion that's driving these results.
Beautiful.
And I think that will be a great frontier for more research, Scott.
Beautiful. And I'll tell you, there's one area of research I'd love to do more on, which relates to this. It seems like there's a cluster of the Big Five when you look at the aspect level that's not just, it's like a triad, which I'm realizing. There's a social effervescence. I love the way you put that. I'm going to call that now. Social effervescence, compassion. And the third one is creative openness.
Yeah.
I actually see this triad. And I would say that's like the ultimate triad for positive social change.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And there are, you know, there are really cool meta-analyses showing that openness piece that you've just introduced, creativity, I'm curious about things, open-mindedness drives power in business contexts, which is very sensible, but very important, right? It's not as important in the military context, for example, highly structured units, but boy, is it important in driving innovation and positive social change in the business world.
Oh, this is great. This is really exciting linkages. I feel so honored to be able to talk to you.
Yeah. I wish I could do some research on this. It's really, these are cool speculations.
We can. It seems like there are these two major, at least two major clusters at the aspect level that you don't see when you just stay at the Big Five. So we just talked about one, but the other one seems to be a more dominance cluster, and that could be assertiveness, maybe disagreeableness. You know, and I'm sure we can stick in a third one if we wanted to somewhere in the conscientiousness, maybe high conscientiousness as well, you know, or grit. Yeah. Grit might be part of that. I don't know. I don't know. I'm just riffing, but it seems like there are at least two major pathways to power within the Big Five.
Yeah. And I think you've nicely charted those configurations. You know, as an offshoot of that, Scott, you know, another personality space that we should be talking about is the dark triad.
Oh, obviously. Love that. Yeah.
Machiavellianism, sociopathy, and narcissism. And my colleague Leanne Tanbrinke and I were really frustrated with the power literature because there's this assumption out there, and it's just a stereotype, right? Just as like people stereotype that women can't be leaders, when in fact a lot of the data show they're better, just as or better than men on average. But there's this stereotype that you got to be a killer to gain power, got to be a sociopath or a Machiavellian. Has really deep intellectual roots that trace back to Niccolo Machiavelli. And so we've actually tested that in two different contexts. One was with U.S. senators, and we published this, I think, in 2015. You code the speeches of U.S. senators for how much humanity and sort of empowering compassion they show versus sociopathy and narcissism. Do they lick their lip and show the high dominance dopamine stuff? And it was really the more just, humane senators who got more support for the bills they were trying to vote. And we've got a paper coming out very soon where we did the same analysis, coding the speeches in terms of their nonverbal behavior of hedge fund managers. And we find that sociopathic, kind of high domineering killer type hedge fund managers do worse for the people who invest in them, right? So I think that these are cautionary tales about our image of power that we need.
Well, that is wonderful findings, and I would love to cite them in my work, if you wouldn't mind following up. Yeah. And this does suggest that, you know, the interpersonal circumplex originally was labeled as the power / status axis. And I don't refer to it as such anymore. It's just agency, you know, because we need to like think like you're saying, you know, and this is largely your point and I'm agreeing with it. But it seems like in that spirit, I'd be happy to retire that description of that axis and open up power to even, you know, like the communal side or that the intersection I was talking about where you have the affiliation plus compassion.
Yeah. And, you know, and we need to do this kind of work on these scales that define parts of our science, right?
Yeah.
They get more refined as science advances, and we need to evolve our scales as well for many different reasons.
Brilliant. It's brilliant. It's such good stuff. So you have this quote, power is given, not grabbed. In a lot of ways, is that a cautionary tale to kind of help us realize that, you know, it were people who gave us that power?
Yeah.
So when it goes to our head, is that a good reminder that we didn't do it all by ourselves?
It's one of the deepest reminders. You know, that idea really came out of a spectacular line of thinking on power by Christopher Boehm, B-O-E-H-M, at USC. And he surveyed the data of hunter-gatherer societies. And I think there are 48 studies in this meta-analysis. And these are people living in small groups that defined our evolution for 200,000 years. It's really the kind of the context in which we developed into the primate that we are today. And he talked about how groups control how much power you have. And they do it by, if you abuse your power, they'll mock you. They'll tease you. They will spread gossip about you. They will openly chastise you, right? And your power, and this is also found in the sociological literature, is given to you by the network you're part of, right? My power in psychological science, my influence, is dependent upon my reputation and what other people think of me. And if they think I'm a jerk or they think I do shoddy science, they're not going to refer to my work. They're going to ignore it. They're going to make fun of it. And it will have no influence in the field. And so your power fundamentally, for the most time, put context, is given to you. And, you know, there are exceptions, obviously. You look at political elections and you look at the machinations of them and vote counting issues and voter suppression and the like. And oops, you suddenly see power can be grabbed. But the broader, and those are important exceptions, but the broader lesson is you're only as good in terms of power as the esteem other people direct to you.
I like that. I think I agree with 50% of that statement then, that power is given, but it looks like power can be, there are two routes to social status from the evolution. So the nuanced, unsexy version is power is given and it could either be grabbed or, you know, the other option. However, there's one version that is more conducive to well-being and ultimate success. And that's a total mouthful.
Yeah. You know, I mean, and it's so interesting, Scott, because, you know, I wrote The Power Paradox, right? Like, power is given, not grabbed.
Yeah.
And I literally published it before Trump rose.
Yeah.
This rise of right wing. I mean, literally a month later, Trump rose.
Yeah. Yeah.
But not only Trump, but we had all this right wing, this emergence of right wing politics that people are very worried about. Where it really looks like, wow, there is a force in the human psyche and in human society that's all about taking others down to grab power. And I had a lot of material on grabbing power that we've been talking about, these two routes to power that I cut out, that is worth really reminding ourselves of.
Yeah, it just seems like, you know, because they use examples in that evolutionary literature, like if you're in jail, I mean, usually the dominant person is the one who really wins and thrives in that environment. Is that right?
Yeah.
You know, so there are certain environments that there's a reason why we evolved those social strategies, as the evolution psychologists call them, exploitative.
And that's where you got to think about the nature of the social system that you're in. So, for example, is there accountability to your actions, right? Because that will diminish domineering power. In prisons, there's no accountability. It's all haywire. There is your action publicly visible. We know people are better behaved when their actions are publicly visible. But when Trump makes his private deals at Mar-a-Lago, or a prisoner is in a prison cell and no one's looking, then coercive power can really reign. Another one that's really important, and it's rising in our conversation today, is what do we value in leaders, right? Do we think it's okay that a leader can swear and grab people's genitalia and, you know, brag about it and act in irrational ways? If we value that, when we value the right kinds of things, that will constrain leaders in really interesting ways to be better behaved. So I think that in part, as Snyder says in his recent book on tyranny, which is really, your audience really should read it. He's a Yale historian. His first principle of tyranny is people give power to tyrants by just backing off, by letting them run roughshod over us. And it really is in our hands to constrain the domineering types of power and the abuses of power.
Oh boy, so we even can make this sentence even more nuanced. Power is given willingly or unwillingly, either through grabbing or compassion. And depending on the context, one or the other will be more conducive to harmonious cooperation or something. That's a big mouthful, but...
Yeah, it is. But I think that, you know, that is the challenge of the day, right?
Yeah. Which is
we have this tendency to give power to people who advance societies.
Yeah.
And there's historical moments where that is corrupted.
Yeah.
And it's still in our hands to give power to the right people.
Yeah. It's such an, what an important message. And it seems like your phrase, power is given, not grabbed. I mean, it has a real new meaning under, you know, the genitalia situation that we had with our current. So when you came up with that phrase, you actually didn't mean that at all, did you? Is that right?
I didn't, you know. But I'll tell you what, and it's interesting for your audience to know that that phrase also came out of really important scholarship on power by Joseph Nye at Harvard University, who's the author of the concept Smart Power and Soft Power. And what he noticed, and I think it's very relevant to today, which is that during the shock and awe campaign, where we bombed the lights out of Iraq, Bush and Cheney, that was one of these really assertive, domineering acts of power. But in point of fact, when you look at the broad effects of that action, right, we lost enormous influence on the worldwide stage, and that's been documented by Joseph Nye. And then when you think about the long-term effects of that single policy on the status of the American people, the trillions of dollars it cost, that cost us, that disempowered us as well. So I think what we see today is another interesting example of where these really coercive forms of power cost individuals and the collectives they represent in the long term.
Yeah. I'm so glad that you and others that you mentioned are doing this kind of research. Without this kind of research, it's very easy to just, for anyone to just, based on their own value system, kind of say what is important. I mean, obviously, the dominant listener to this conversation will be laughing at us, right?
And I know.
Yeah.
And that's life.
It's chumps. They would call this chumps, right? You know, I've dealt with bullies so much in my childhood that I know exactly how it is. So what are I think maybe we talked about that a little bit in the last chat. I can't remember, but I'm feeling deja vu right now. This is a common thing we talk about. Bullies. I'd love to talk a little about what are some of the pathways to enduring power. And that's another aspect of your book I really loved, how you, this even the phrase enduring power, it's a powerful phrase to me. So can you maybe tell the listeners some of those pathways?
Yeah, you know, power is such a rush, right? That like, wow, I feel powerful. I'm at the top of the game. You know, and I've been teaching this stuff to managers and executives and leaders for 20 years. And the smart ones are recognized. Yeah, it is a rush. It's great. If the dopamine high that we've talked about. But what really matters is what your life looks like after, you know, 50 years of work and in a relationship or relationships and what you do in the community. And that's really enduring power, right? And the Greeks were very interested in this question of at the end of life, what have you given? And to me, that's the deeper question about power is how have you influenced others over the long haul of life and not just in the moment of rising to the top? And that then begs the question of what pathways lead to enduring influence. And one, notwithstanding certain critiques, is empathy, is just make it a practice to think about what other people are thinking, to take on their feelings, to listen to their wisdom. You know, I was blown away in reading about Abraham Lincoln that, as Thurlow Weed, a journalist who followed him at the time, said, his political genius was that he heard all who came to speak to him. He read everything that was written to him, and he listened with a genius intent, right? He just absorbed himself in other people's minds, empathy. And when you look at great leaders, they have this quality. And then there are people like Stéphane Côté, who's finding, wow, it's really the empathetic managers who keep their power, who have enduring power. Then, you know, a second one is the recognition that we've talked about that is really just hyper-connecting in, you know, this dimension to extroversion, Scott, that you've really sharply brought into focus of, like, you know, just make sure that you're always, don't seduce yourself into thinking your power is the product of your genius or your incredible talents. Really, it's your enduring power is related to the networks you build. This is true of primates, Franz de Waal's work on chimps. It's true of hunter-gatherer societies, and it's true today, right? So there are studies of organizations showing if you want to really drive social change in the organization, have power, be it a scientific society or a finance firm, you're hyper-connected, right? So just make sure you're connecting, having fun, laughing, reaching out to others. And then, you know, I'll get pro-social on you, but, you know, I think kindness and sharing are fundamental in the long haul. And, you know, there are meta-analyses showing, with a little bit of data showing agreeableness, which you've talked about, that one of the big five, yeah, kindness helps you keep power.
Yeah.
And when you study great leaders, very often they have this real, really clear devotion to other people. Now, you know, there are bullies out there who may be laughing at us, but there are data that align with these ideas.
Because those are the ones that are made fun of by the bullies. I mean, that's really what's going on in middle school. The ones that are the most made fun of are the nerds, the humanitarians, the one, you know, the sweet little girl who brings cookies for the teacher, then gets bullied, and my heart breaks. It's horrible. But I think that's what we see, though, right?
Yeah, I agree. And you know, you've brought into focus, you know, and it's a little bit in the power paradox, which is there is this struggle over power. Is it the Machiavellian domineering bullying type, and that does prevail in places, versus this pro-social collaborative type? Yeah. And there are contexts where that is a battle, right?
Yeah.
And it's this historical battle that we have to engage in, be it on the playground or in the U.S. Senate.
Totally. And the person who might be the bully in school, that could be coming from a place of intense powerlessness for that person. So we should be clear that these are malleable characteristics. Sometimes the bully can grow up to channel in a way once they get power and in positive, beneficial things. But as you make the point in your book, that a lot of that hubris and arrogance and exploitation can come from a place of a person feeling like they don't have any power, right?
Yeah. And we have to remember, you know, bullies were bullied. Very often they're abused. They suffer depression and anxiety at higher rates, right?
Yeah.
And so remember that, as you say. It comes from a place of defensiveness or even weakness.
It's hard to remember that when you're being bullied, but
I've been there.
Yeah, we can, of course, remember that. Just I'll end here. You know, maybe you could just go with one or two pathways to enduring power, because you talk about a fivefold pathway, and you say, how can we outsmart the power paradox? So maybe you just want to leave one way that your favorite on how we can outsmart the power paradox.
Well, you know, I've already talked about sharing and empathy and kindness, but one that really struck me as I wrote this book, Scott, and is humility. And, you know, humility is this complex construct, as you know, which is it's about having an accurate sense of who you are. So it's a counter to the narcissism we've talked about. But it's also mixed in with what you spoke of, Scott, which is a curiosity about other people.
Yeah.
You know, just a recognition of how important other people are. And that really is the texture of humility. And I remember I got to work on Inside Out with Pete Docter And, you know, Pete was the director of Up, Monsters, Inc., and then Inside Out. Oscar winner. You know, Inside Out ended up being one of the best reviewed movies of the year, won an Oscar, et cetera. And Pete manages 250 people to make a movie, right? That's power. His movies reach hundreds of millions of people. They're billion-dollar enterprises. And I remember having lunch with him after he won the Oscar, you know, and he was so humble about the endeavor. You know, he was like, God, there were certain things I got wrong. It really was due to Ronnie Del Carmen, my assistant director. I really want to improve on this. You know, there was such humility in his reflection on things. And I think when you find people who enjoy enduring power in their family or love life or at work, there's humility there. And that's what we've got to go after.
That's wonderful. We're going to end on that note because it's a wonderful note to end on. Thank you so much for your being so generous and being in the Psychology Podcast twice now and offering your wisdom.
Scott, I will talk with you anytime. It's awesome to talk to you. I've got 9 research ideas I got to go say.
Thank you so much for listening to the Psychology Podcast with Dr. Scott Barry Kaufman. I hope you found this episode just as thought-provoking as I did. If something you heard today stimulated you in some way, I encourage you to join in the discussion at thepsychologypodcast.com. That's thepsychologypodcast.com.